yet I bar my door to no one. Is a pursuit of men, away in the distant world, no more sinful than the making of rifles or the charging of quit-rent? Yet do I prefer an honest quarrel out in the open myself. 'Tis more manly somehow, don't you think? Dixon ambles closer, beaming. Yet 'tis a gormless spy indeed, who'd lurk where there are no more secrets to steal. How so? What is there that has not been visited, intentionally and not, 100 times? Gathering ginseng would be more profitable. Shelby is, of course, also a surveyor, who ranges these mountains all about, bearing and wielding his instrument like a weapon. Oh, I saw upon the instant how this was, darkly to Dixon. I saw how the ancient sorcerers must have enjoyed what they did. At our pleasure, we may look through this brazen tube, through glass mathematically shaped, and whatever desirable scene sweeps by as we turn it. Why, 'tis ours for writing down the angle. Good heavens, what power! There is a love of complexity here in America, Shelby declares. Pure space waits the surveyor. No previous lines, no fences, no streets to constrain polygamy, however extravagant. Especially in Maryland, where, encouraged by the resurvey laws, warranted properties may possess hundreds of sides, their angles pushing outward and inward, all sides zigging and zagging, going ahead and doubling back, making loops inside loops. In America, 'twas ever Poe to simple quadrilaterals. Hey, Dixon nodding vaguely, he's never regarded his occupation in quite this way before. His journeyman years coincided with the rage then sweeping Durham for enclosure. Aye, and alas, he had attended at that altar. He had sliced into polygons the common lands of his forebears. He had drawn lines of ink that became fences of stone. He had broken up herds of fell sheep to be driven ragged and dingy off through the rain to gates and exile. He had turned the same covetous angles as the Welshman, though perhaps never as many, for Shelby seemed seized with goniolatry or the worship of angles, defining tracts of virgin land by as many of these exhilarating instrumental sweeps as possible. Things to survey your domain, even if you don't own it. Here at the Allegheny Crest, you may stand and look either way, down mile after mile of the visto you've cut, and from your eminence pretend that you own it. Every girl, every gambler, tonic salesman, and banjo player that comes down that line could easily be paying tribute to somebody. Not a lot, no worse than quitrent. A nuisance levy, really, even if it's a song or a card trick or 10 minutes in the hayloft. Shelby accompanies them over North Mountain, whereupon it begins to rain and snow, and continues so for the next 10 days. The cards come out, and the chapbooks, and dice, and bottles. Mason goes to sleep, requesting that he be wakened only in case of spring. Dixon tries to learn from Captain Zhang something of the Luapan in exchange for instruction as to the sector. The attention we are paying these zenith stars, he suggests, has brought me to imagine an anti-celestial or backwards astrology in which the stars must be projected inward somehow, mapped from the celestial sphere onto the surface of our globe. At Greenwich, for example, the zenith star is Gamma Draconis, putting Britain into the terrestrial sign of Draco, the dragon. Just so, the geomancer twinkles. Yet in Durham, we mean something different when we say dragon. Ours are not at all the Chinese variety. Some, like the Lambton worm, lacking wings and a fire-breathing capacity, may indeed be of a distinct species. You've seen such a creature? Heard the story when growing up. As Lambton Castle lies almost upon the North Sea, we at Cockfield knew it as a Weir Valley tale, that, like an ageless salmon, had worked its way over the years upstream to us. At the Market Square in Bishop, as at Darlington Fair, the tale was often performed by troops of traveling actors, 6 of whom would be needed for the part of the worm. The drop was painted to suggest the sea fret whispering along the walls, mysterious shapes in the park beyond, as romantic as you please. Today, the country round Lambton is thick with collieries and pretty much given over to staiths and chutes and wagon rails. But the river then was purer and wilder, not yet altogether converted to the service of the Christian God, though, as it happened, fishing in it on Sunday in these parts had long been forbidden. They take out pipes, which Captain Zhang fills with a blend of cured vegetation that he will describe only as Chinese tobacco. courteously igniting both with embers from the fire. The heedless John Lambton, his lordship's heir, a young man as malapert in company as he is masterly in a stream, his own reach of the weir in particular, has long refused to honor this rule. One Sunday, instead of the salmon trout he believes his due, he pulls in a small snake-like thing with a double row of horrid little vents either side of it, from its head down the body, gasping open and shut. 9 pair of them. At first he takes it for a lamprey, but lampreys have only 7 pair. This thing is different. He feels a strange cold at his temples, a conscious vibration in the fishing line. It seems to him almost that the creature is gazing into his eyes with a look of intelligent evil. Just then his friend Reginald comes galloping up with a couple of pack horses. All right then, John, come along. There'll be no moors left by the time we get to Jerusalem. What? The crusade. Oh, bother, you said you'd come. I say, what's that on your line? Ghastly thing. Throw it back in. Let's go bash old Abdul. What? Yes, but Reggie, I'm not sure the river's quite the place for it. Best interests of the fish, and so on. Here, looky, here's this hole with some stones round the edge. I'll just chuck it in here, shall I? But isn't it someone's well? Some tenant or something, who cares? And with one of those nightly flourishes, the young fool, damned in the instant, actually tosses the worm into the well. Oh, John, cries Reggie, that's so amusing. And thus, cheerily, the lads are off to the east, where a number of desperate adventures wait them. Meanwhile, the worm is far from idle, having almost immediately begun, in that womb of wet stone, to grow. Local people hear it thrashing about, and the bravest, as they peer down into the echoing dark, may almost see it. Soon the water has acquired an unpleasant taste, metallic, sour, heavy with a reptilian musk. Buckets let down do not come back up. Creaking noises are heard at night as the well's casing is brought under some enormous force. Till one morning, as the sun rises, so up over the rim of the well appears a great blazing pair of eyes, the closely set, purposeful eyes of a predator. Slowly, with no appearance of effort, it begins to ascend from the well, accompanied by a terrible, poisonous odor, flowing up over the edge. Indeed, it keeps coming for longer than it should. Everything living in the area, including the vegetation, stop what they're doing and attend. The worm seems quite hungry. Taking its time, the worm proceeds to one of the bats or islands in the river, where it sets up its base of operation. Its needs are simple: food, drink, and the pleasure to be had from killing. It eats sheep and swine. It drains milk from cattle 9 at a time. The number 9 recurs in the tale, though the reason is dark, and careless dogs, cats, and humans are but light snacks to it. Around it, a circle of devastation appears, pale and soiled, which no one enters, and which the world must keep shifting for, a little at a time, as it goes on widening. The worm each day venturing a little further from its base, till at length the circle of terror advances to include a direct view of the battlements of Lambton Castle itself, the final sanctuary, surely inviolable, although the people in the castle dare not try to organize an exodus, for the worm, when it must, can travel at great speed, faster than horses can gallop. They have watched in terror many chases to the death across the tide plain below, as, once alerted, the worm has easily cut its victims off in the open, far from any refuge or escape. So there begins an obsession by the worm. The chapel is never empty now. The steward has begun taking inventory. Rationing lists are in early but serious negotiation. Days once idle are now filled with defensive chores. Engineers try to get the trebuchet on the roof into working order, tweaking the shape of the sling release hook. The worm is by now grown so large that it may comfortably coil round the entire castle. One day there will come to it some sign, the call of a raven, the exact shape of a moon, the racing shadow of a cloud, which will lead, by an unreadable train of serpent thought, to a convulsive breaching of these walls and a merciless search within. A face suddenly looming in the roofless sky, a feast. No one can say when. The evil one has Lambton Castle literally in its embrace. The local folk keep a vigil, blending in against the brush on the somber hillsides, calculating how fast they'll have to move when the creature turns its attention to them. Days pass, presently weeks. The worm continues to enlarge its zone of emptiness, but with a change of center, returning now after each excursion to coil about the castle, where it lies all night, digesting loudly its day's predation. It is into this increasingly desperate siege that John Lambton now returns from his crusade. At first look, impaling foreigner seems to have agreed with him. He is tanned and fit and easy in the saddle. But beneath the hearty mask lies a dread of what he will encounter. Approaching the castle, he can smell the worm long before he sees it. He would have much preferred a dragon, dragons having from time to time in County Durham chosen to infest the roads and lay desolate the countryside, it falling, usually, to such known anti-draconical families as the Latimers, Wyvils, or Mowbrays to respond. But those creatures were winged and clawed, fire-breathing, noble in conformation, the reptilian detailing ever harmless, almost an afterthought. Nothing like what John Lambton, rounding the last bend before home, beholds, recognizes, and understands as his own creation, something he must now, before God, deal with. Time has not been kind to the worm he threw in the well. It had been unpleasant enough to look at when only elver size. Now, despite what he has seen in the east, he must labor not to turn away. The 18 vents have grown astonishingly, and hang, pulsating, each surrounded by a deep black annulus of something glistering and corroded. The face has lost the youthful malevolence that Lambton remembers, has rather become, deep in its abandonment, now purely a weapon in the service of blood lust, a serpent's gift for paralyzing its prey with a certain gaze that the potential luncheon, once returning it, is helpless to defy. Even Lambton, though at a safe enough distance, finds it strangely attractive. He has not exactly been to the Holy Land. Where he ended up, in fact, was Transylvania, this being one of the very last crusades, taken up more in a privateering spirit by one Cardinal Cesarini and a party of adventurers from many lands, who, by breaking the truce of Szeged and then losing at the Battle of Varna, helped prepare the way for the Turks who were to capture Constantinople a few years later. During a long Iliad of hard soldiering and small, mortal, never decisive engagements amid dramatic hilltops, haunted castles, mysterious flocks of bats that always seemed to be lingering about, Lambton one night, seeking diversion, had visited the encampment of a band of gypsies, who included in their number a sibyl widely respected for having successfully foretold every wedding, birth, adultery, and flow of wealth in this locality for longer than anyone could remember. Solemnly, she informed him of the exact situation prevailing at Lambton Castle. "Then must I hasten home to destroy this monster. Shall I prevail?" "Akshanat, I do not do deaths. I am far too cheerful. You want to see a Romanian for that sort of thing." "'Twould be little more than a sporting contest," young Lambton talking fast. "No more violent than jousting, really." "My lord, please, my time is as precious as yours. What I can do is bring in a priest here, divide the fee, arrange an oath for you." "Anything," he assured her, "but quickly." The oath was fairly simple. He read it over a few times, couldn't find much wrong with it, so willingly knelt beside his sword and vowed that if God should allow him victory over the worm, he would sacrifice unto him the first living thing he then happened to see. There are penalty clauses, the priest helpfully pointing them out upon the long piece of parchment he just signed. "If I prevail, then so drenched in blood shall I be that bloodshed will weigh less upon my conscience than it does even here in Transylvania," avowed the open-faced yet somber young heir. "Therefore, I shall not default." Once back in Durham, however, having come to think of God under the aspect more of fortune than of anything more churchly, he understands that his duty also includes providing what he can, himself, on earth, to shorten his odds. Choosing from among the small crowd of youths always to be found, when the worm is away, about the approaches to the castle, seeking engagement as runners, Lambton arranges for his father, immediately the worm's destruction shall be signaled by a blast upon a hunting horn, to send out one of the castle hounds. Neither Lambton thinks of this as cheating. It will be a legitimate sacrifice. Every one of those dogs is like family. Young Lambton next rides up to Washington, the colonel's ancestral home, in fact, to consult with the armorsmith who fitted him out for his crusade. Galloping towards the glow of the forge, visible for miles, now and then reflected in the weir, he considers his basic tactical problem, which is the worm's reported ability, even hacked into separate pieces by conventional sword work, to reassemble itself and fight on. "I've been looking into this very difficulty," the armorer greets him. "Glad you came by. Here, come and see." Inside the shop, lit by the lurid glow of the coals, with a sweating apprentice staring at them unfathomably, gleams a suit of armor, to young Lambton's exact measurements, provided all over with hundreds of firmly attached sword-quality blades, whose honed edges flicker with sanguinary light. "Perfect! It won't be able to use its coils. It'll have to come head-on, and happen I'll get lucky with my pike." They discuss tactics far into the night. He returns with the armor packed in straw. For the first time, he understands that everywhere about, for leagues, sleep souls in real bodies, mortal as any in Hungary, impossible longer to ignore, and that at dawn, by way of their dreams, will they all wake knowing what is to happen that day. Young Lambton chooses to wait out upon the worm's own bat, the river flowing swiftly by on either side. Birds are subdued, treed. For the benefit of observers, of whom there are many, he kneels a moment, appearing to repeat his sacred oath, before rising to put on, very carefully, piece by razor-keen piece, his bloodletting suit, till all at last is ready. Then he hears it, the unimagined tons of wet and purposeful flesh, moving a clatter through the reeds, ever closer, till out of the riparian mist emerges, towering, the savage head, the death-like face of the great worm. It hisses in a long exhalation. When the smell reaches him, young Lambton smiles grimly. "Plenty of time to vomit when we're done, thanks." The fight is slow, bloody, repetitive. A dream, fever-shot, unwaking. It lasts most of the day. Small boys approach as close as they dare. Adolescent rogues comment upon the weaponry, the suit, the hacking technique. Townsfolk watch from the hillsides, the red, thrashing immensity filling the river, and the tiny, glittering night. To his obstinacy, there seems no limit. Those who remember him as a flighty and lazy child marvel at the change. Before he went off to Jerusalem, he'd have run away, the bugger. Young Lambton fights on. At last, after too many cuts, deep and deeper, the worm's capacity for self-repair is overcome. It lets out a series of last liquid, hateful screams, echoing up the valley all the way to Chesterley Street, and perishes, to be borne away, most of its blood ahead of it, already halfway to Dogger Bank, chunks of flesh forever separate, out into the North Sea, where even the most voracious of the fish will only pick at it. With the last of his strength, Lambton climbs to the now-delivered castle, stands before it, and blows upon his olifant. The dogs inside hear it, and all start barking at once. They grow so agitated that none of the Lambton servants dares approach them. Meanwhile, blissfully having forgotten about the terms of the oath, vertiginous in a storm of emotions, the elder Lambton can think only of seeing his son again. He is an aged man, but he runs as he can over the drawbridge, arms held out. "John, oh my boy!" He is, of course, the first living thing young Lambton sees. "Hey!" Young John just stands there, almost too tired to realize what has happened. Now, by the terms of his contract, 'tis his father he must kill. It would be easy. So foolish in his transport is the old man that a single embrace, folding him tightly but without mercy into the bladed vambraces and breastplate of the worm-stained armor, would do the job. He could say he had been too exhausted to think. Then, again, the oath was taken in Hungary. As God exempts England from many of Europe's less agreeable obligations to history, so surely must oaths taken in foreign lands, at which foreign priests and gypsies attend, be without force here. He allows himself this sophistry. It delays acting upon what he already knows, that he cannot kill his father, that he must break the oath, as he once consciously broke the truce of Szeged. Thus already corrupted, why shouldn't he? He lets go his sword, the image of the cross he has sworn upon, lets it fall, turns, walks away, looking for someone who can help him out of the edged and now perhaps even venomous iron weapon he is wearing. Henceforth, when attending to internal business, he will put it on again and again for the rest of his life. The penalty stipulated in the contract, to remain in force for 9 generations, one for each pair of holes in the creature, was that no Lord of Lambton die in his bed. Under this gypsy curse, one by one, they drowned, they were killed in battle, Wakefield, Marston Moor, sure it was, none died in bed. The last, the 9th Lord, was Henry Lambton, and one of my letters from Durham brought me, whilst at the Cape, news that he'd died 3 weeks after the transit of Venus, riding across the new Lambton Bridge in his carriage. Halfway between shores, murmurs Mason, his mortal transit how brief! Never to reach Lambton, his own bit of earth. Actually, he was heading the other way, says Dixon, out over the weir into the world, another adventure. Cruelly served, it seems to the Reverend, 9 innocent generations. Whatever aid against the worm young Lambton invoked, its source required blood sacrifices. Because he spared his own father's life, it cursed him and his line most grievously for hundreds of years. What agency could be so remorselessly cruel? Is it possible that at the battle in the weir, the wrong forces won? Why, Christ won that day. Dixon, whose present state of religiosity is a puzzle to everyone, appears to find it curious that anyone could think otherwise. Christians won, anyway, pronounces Captain Shelby. Albeit, Reverend Cherrycoke suggests, the worm may have embodied an older way of proceeding, very like the ancient alchemists' tales, meant to convey by symbols certain secret teachings. Is that worm in that well? That's the signature here. Set in a tent opening, twilight breeze off the mountain flowing in around him, flaming autumn sky behind him, Evan Shelby is suddenly taller, more sly and cruel than he seemed at first meeting, with a way of rolling his eyes to convey Celtic madness. The ancient figure of the serpent through the ring, or sacred copulation, a much older magic, and certainly one the Christians wanted to eradicate. Thoughts that in my line of work are too often denounced as Stukeley-esque, or at the least Stonehengical, adds the Reverend. Not to mention Masonic, Dixon broadly pollicating his partner, but Mason is hundreds of chains removed into morosity, accepting without full attention a glazed jug of the local white corn whiskey from the captain, who continues, "Nevertheless, sir, the serpent mound, which is at Avebury in England, looks very like one I have seen to the west of here, across Ohio. They might have been built by quite similar races of people." Red savages in Britain? Reverend Cherrycoke, a bit puzzled. "Sir, when you go out there and talk to them about it," Captain Shelby insists, "the Indians tell you that the serpent, as the other earthworks unnumbered of that country, was already ancient by the time their own people arrived. Indians speak of a race of giants who built them. I had to hide all night once within the coils of some serpent. They fancy the fiercer animals. All night, the Shawanese kept their distance, and I even managed to sleep, briefly but in great comfort, somehow certain they would never venture close enough to find me. I woke strangely energized. The foe had vanished. The dawn was well under way." In the distance, a wench shouts, "There, Tom, you've ripped me bodice again." Captain Shelby rolls a paternal eye outdoors in her direction. Nothing that passes here must escape him. The surveyors, enjoying previous acquaintance eastward of here with wilderness squires upon the model of Captain Shelby, have already discussed his character. Large eyebrows, Mason had opined, betray a leaning to pugnacious eccentricity. There is a passage in Pliny to that effect, or there ought to be. We're about as far from Philadelphia here as Durham from London, Dixon offered. Much further, if you figure in the trees and things, precipices, gorges, and it seems quite like home, west being for Americans what north is for Geordies, an increasing likelihood of local power lying in the hands of eccentrics, more independence, more Scottismus, as I'd say. And brows of dauntless courage and considerate pride, waiting revenge, the Reverend had quoted them Milton upon Satan. And really, the odd thing, the captain's eye now rolling back fiendishly to play full upon Dixon, is that from the level of the ground, why, it seems but a high wall of dirt. The only way even to make out the serpent shape of it is from 100 feet straight up. Dixon reddens, believing for no reason that Shelby somehow knows of his childhood flights over the fells. There must be a hilltop, a tall tree, close by. Not close enough to spy down upon it from, regrettably, sir. Anyone who wonders what imps look like in their middle years would be perhaps more than satisfied with Shelby's fizz at the moment. Malice undiminished, with a daily schedule that leaves him too little time to express it. Then Mason catches himself about to ask how Captain Shelby can know what the plan view looks like unless he has himself gained an impossible altitude, noting also the thicketed eyebrows of the Welshman waiting, rearranged, for just this question. You must appreciate this is no idle drudgery, not some band of savages groping about earthbound for the correct shape. Rather, 'tis a sure artist's line, the curves sweeping in preordained accommodation to the river. If I grow too rhapsodic, pray set the dogs upon me. You would need to see one of these works to understand. Chapter 61. So, quite early the next morning, there they both are, about to go visit one of the local mounds with the possibly unstable Captain Shelby as their guide. The frost along the tent rigging bleached in the last of the moon, their breaths upon the air remaining white for longer than 'twould seem they ought. Mason and Dixon step out of the perimeter, into the wild, now as entirely subject to the captain's notions of grace as any Romans lured by promises of forbidden knowledge in the care of an inscrutable druid. "Come along," cries the captain jovially. "We need to be there just at sunrise." "Folly," Mason mutters. "Aye," Dixon replies, "you'd have preferred the moonlight, I guess, and an owl or two." Down by the creek, they fall in with the path Shelby means to follow. The North Mountain rears above them, soon to catch the first light at its crest. Trees fill with whistling. Squadrons of cloud go rushing in the sky. The breeze has a cold edge. Dead leaves are everywhere. Soon all odor of wood smoke has faded behind them. That of ripeness, come and gone, enfolds them, and then something else. There's a new barrel mill in the neighborhood. Smell it? They are coming near the bank of a creek. Shelby, eyebrows wrinkling together, takes hold of his shot bag and begins to toss it lightly in his hand. He seems eager to begin firing at any target that may present itself. Grist millers, he declares, discover there is more money in grinding out cheap barrels for rifles for the savages. Philadelphia money. Here, up this way. Mist is gathered in the hollows, thick and cohering, blinding whilst carrying to each the breaths and mutterings of the others. Everywhere between these white episodes, the clarity of the dawn slowly, piercingly emerges. "This ridge, another valley," the captain exhorts them, "and we are there." Over the crest and down to ford, and then follow the creek through a gap in the hills to another stream, where, in the angle of confluence, its tip just catching the first rays of the sun, stands Captain Shelby's mound. "Hey," cries Dixon, "why, 'tis a great cone." "Regular as Silbury Hill," Captain Shelby's head at an admiring angle. Mason, slow to enthusiasm, sniffs the air. no fermented maize fumes about, but then 'tis still, so to speak, early in the day. My sacred word, the Welshman, rolling his eyes heavenward, producing, however, an effect more of madness than of piety. Come, boys, come. They are boys. They approach the giant solid, alone upon its promontory, as light slowly envelops it, dyeing it a cold, crystalline rose. Mason's first question, though he refrains from asking it aloud, is, might it be under invisible guard? And how zealous are they? Shelby, watching his face, knows gleefully enough his apprehensions. How do the Indians hear about fancy spectators like us? Dixon asks. They laugh. They but appear a solemn people, worshipping laughter, rather, as a serious, indeed holy, force in nature, never to be invoked idly. This mound is something they understand perfectly. That white people do not, and show no signs of ever doing so, is a source of deep amusement for them. Is there a way inside? There shouldn't be, but there is. The Welshman's eyes tighten. It was broken into years ago, perhaps by some larcenous fool who had it confused with a pyramid. His disappointment was the only good thing to come of it, for he found nothing. No ancient corpses, nor even copper bracelets or tobacco pipes, for Indians never built it. Hey, cries Dixon, who's been peering into the opening. Do you see this, how these layers are set in, Mason? That device Mr. Franklin showed us, his Leyden jar. Remember thee all that fancy layering inside it? Yes, impatiently, but those were gold leaf, silver foil, glass, philosophical materials. A quick glance toward Shelby, whilst these, having a squint, seem but different kinds of refuse, dirt, ashes, crushed seashells. Not likely to be an ancient Leyden battery, Dixon, if that's what you're thinking. A marvel no one taught you this, Mr. Mason, for there is lengthy knowledge of such things, according to which alternating layers of different substances are ever a sign of the intention to accumulate force, not necessarily electrical, neither. Perhaps, Captain, these substances Mr. Mason so disrespects may yet be suited to forces more telluric in nature, more attuned, that is, to death and the slower phenomena. Mason is shaking his head, having no idea how to control ranting like this, genial though it be. He's long known that leadership is not his best quality. Captain Shelby is staring at them both, with apprehension more than curiosity, for he has seen the deep woods and its mysteries quite derange more than one visitor from the seacoast and beyond. Deciding to place his faith in reason, you'll note how the sunlight has been creeping down the cone, a progressive warming of the structure, the diameters of each infinitesimal ring at each moment being the crucial values. Did either of you bring a compass? Here's one, eh? Dixon, regarding his needle, feels himself begin to drift somewhere else, off at an angle to the serial curve of his life. Mason peers over his shoulder. Right into Dixon's ear.
Ah!
Leaping away. Mason, don't do that! He struggles to refocus, in fact, to remember where he is. The needle is swinging wildly and without pause, rocking about like a weather vane in a storm. Dixon pretending to gaze at it knowingly. Mason, a squint. Well, thank you for allowing us to witness your experience. Aye, very helpful indeed. Shelby would have preferred the slow chatter of three men in the early morning with naught more to discuss than the day ahead. This structure happens to be quite in the projected path of your line, he informs them. When at length your visto is arrived here, the mound will become active, as an important staging house for whatever it may be, with an attempt at a chuckle, though it comes out too loud and imperfectly controlled. To quote Mr. Tox in his famous Pennsylvaniad, a force intensifier, as 'tis styled, a geomantic engine in the wild, whose task is sending on what comes along, as brisk as air, and several times as strong. Welsh in origin, it goes without saying. How so, Welsh Indians? Oh, absolutely. Only a few days west and south of here. 'Twas in the Turkish spy but a few years since. The Kimri, Captain Shelby explains, having first come to Britain from far to the east, some say Babylon, some Nineveh, their fate ever to be westering. America but one of their dwelling places, the ocean nearly irrelevant. Hugh Crawford believes they are the Tuscaroras. Come along. He leads them uphill again to what seems the ruin of a wall and circling part of the hilltop, where he stoops and brushes away some dirt. Here, inscribed in a roughly dressed stone, they see a line of brief strokes, some pointing up, some down, some both ways. These are all over the British Isles. It's a writing called Ogham, invented by Hugh Godarn the Mighty, who led the first Kimric settlers into Britain. As you'll note, 'tis useful for those who must move on quickly, yet do wish to scribble down something to commemorate their presence. What does it say? Well, as nearly as I can make out, astronomers beware, surveyors too, this means you. Of course, I haven't read any of this for centuries, yet 'tis indisputably Old Welsh. As you describe this line, opines the professor back at camp, the marker stones, set at regular intervals, a cascaded array of units each capable of producing a force, I do suspect we have the same structure as a Leyden battery, and, need I add, of a torpedo. With the head aimed close by Newcastle? Or the other way, were the cascade reversible, the emitted blast being as easily directed westward as east? Either direction 'twould be a pip of a weapon, even with your marker stones placed no further than Sidling Hill. Why fire at Sidling Hill? Dixon, all innocence. Not at the hill, chuckles Captain Shelby, at what's coming over the hill. Pontiac? The French? Too late for them. One day, one of you'll risk a peep over the ridge line, and then you'll see. More mountains, says Mason. Exactly. Mountains such as these, which may be lived among the year round. Therein ever rocks the cradle of rebellion. Sooner or later, something up here will grow hungry or hopeless enough to want to descend to the plain, to stoop like hawks upon rich Chesapeake, aye, the metropolis itself. If the black boys so easily had their way with the British regulars at Shippensburg, who knows what wonders are yet possible out here, over the North Mountain? Yet removing trees to create a pair of perfectly straight edges is to invite Shaw, as Captain Zhang, ever eager upon the topic of the line and its visible expression upon the landscape, with its star-dictated indifference to the true inner shape, or dragon of the land, will be happy to indicate to them. They came from the sky. They prepared to emplace these webs of right lines upon the earth. Then, without explanation, they went away again. Their work is being continued by the Jesuits, inscribers of meridians, whether in blind obedience to some ancient coercion long expired, or in witting complicity with it, who can say? Captain Zhang can, of course, imagine Jesuits guilty of anything, including conspiring with extraterrestrial visitors to mark the living planet with certain signs for motives of their own, motives they do not discuss, especially not with their Jesuit hirelings. Hearken, gentlemen, someone wants your visto, not your line, nor the boundary it defines. Those are but a pretext for the actual cleared straight track. In the domain of very slow undulations we're discussing here, wood is as much an element as air or water. Living trees, in particular, producing a force that might interfere in too costly a way with whatever is to be sent up and down this line. Earth, withal, is a body like our own, with its network of points disposed along its meridians, much as our medicine in China has identified upon the human body a like set of lines invisible, upon which, bead-wise, are strung points, where the flow of qi may be beneficially strengthened by insertions of gold needles. So this arrangement of oolite shafts, at least partly inserted into the earth, you see, it is suggestive. Do we want to hear this? Captain Shelby inquires plaintively. Old. 'Twill be legal evidence of his insanity. Allow him to... yes, then, Captain, you were saying, and how fascinating that you believe the planet Earth to be a living creature, Exactly as the creatures microscopic upon your skin believe you to be a planet. They may be arguing even now about whether or not you are a form of life. Each time you step into a tub, there comes upon them another universal flood, with its animalcular Noah, and another re-inhabiting, another chain of generations, to them how timeless, till the next wash. Some reason that bottle isn't moving more briskly, Dixon wishes to know. Thank ye. Now, Mason, don't tell the hump, but the captain's right. Right? Consider. We've an outer and an inner surface, haven't we, which, mathematically, 'tis easy, using fluxions, to warp and smooth by small continuous changes into a toroid, with openings at either end, leading to... Hold, cries Mason. An inner surface? Are you by chance seeking analogy between the human body and the planet Earth? The Earth has no inner surface, Dixon. Have you been to its end to see... Though I come from pretty far north, Stig puts in, yet there's a lot more north, north of even that, out of which, now and then, a sail will appear upon the horizon. A snow craft approach all the day long, and at evening at last put in at our little village. Everyone crowds into the inn by the light of bare fat candles to drink cloudberry flip and listen to the visitors' tales of a great dark cavity up there, mirrored overhead as by a water sky, funnel-shaped, leading inside the earth to another world. Grant me patience, O Lord, Mason with a bleak expression holding his head. When 'tis not the 11 days missing from the new style, or the cock-lane ghost, yet abides the hollow earth as a proven lure and sanctuary to all that too lightly bestow their faith. Why, snorts Dixon, half of all the philosophers in Durham are hollow earthers. That accounts for Emerson, hisses Mason. Who was the other again? Lud Ofery, glowers Dixon. Marvelous chap, and he ever spoke highly of thee. Dixon, pray you, think. If Newton's figure is correct, if the density of the earth, on average, is between 5 and 6 times that of water, then the shell of this hollow earth of yours, be it hundreds of miles thick, would have to possess some quite impossibly high density to make up for the empty interior. At least, say, 12 times that of water, maybe more. Where is the evidence of this? Solid rock is but 2.5 times as dense as water. What more could be down there? Precisely what the Royal Society would wish to know. You've not, mentioned this to... Pausing to consider how not to give offense. Some believed me, some didn't. Some took me for a Jesuit agent angling for a northern expedition of some kind. Mr. Birch, bless him, immediately went off to make converts. Others asked questions that have to turn more or less rude. My mining background and so forth. A Geordie descends into the earth just once, and right away everyone starts to get ideas. Dixon, on now like a tree full of ravens, with his hollow earth and enthusiasm, Mason judges, too developed to be argued away without investing more time and patience than he possesses. Withal, he is too open himself to the seductions of melancholy and its own comfortless phantoms to call anything even as remotely hopeful as this into question. No more doubts for Mason, just at the moment, thank you, considering however less serviceable to him, as his days spin onward, they are proving to be. China may once have been another planet, Captain Zhang is now speculating, embedded into the earth through some very slow collision, long ago, all populated, with its language and customs, arriving from the east-northeast, aiming for the Pacific, overshoots, plows into Asia, pushes up the Himalaya range, comes to rest intact, which is how, until the first Christian travelers, it remains. Taking this courteously, if not perhaps seriously, Dixon replies, yet from all we know, from Newton onward, how could the mechanism of its approach have been other than swift and cataclysmic? Why, if within the last few miles of mutual approach, a repulsive force were to come into play between the Earth and the Chinese planet, acting counter to and thus slowing the collision, by analogy, of course, to Father Boscovich's theory of repulsion, at very close distance among the primordial atoms of nature. Dixon shakes his head, as if to clear some passage within. This is Jesuit physics. Why are you telling us this? Why must you ever be subtle? Is this what Jesuits believe to be the origin of China? Sarpazzo does. The Chinaman beams and nods, as if Dixon has just understood a joke. The night before they set out westward again, Captain Shelby, from behind a can of his own ale, brewed in the shed adjoining, his face composed, inquires of them, "Where is the third surveyor?" Mason, mistrustful, looks about as if this newcomer might be at hand. Dixon, understanding Shelby to be posing a riddle, is pulled between loyalty to Mason and despair at his slowness in these matters. "Pray, Captain," he feels obliged to play in, "what third surveyor is that? For we are but two." "Why," chuckles Shelby, "you are wise men from the East, and everyone knows they come in threes." "Hey, hey, that's a canny one for fair." Mason is less amused. The captain's discourse verges upon impiety. Furthermore, it seems a bad omen. "Well, it's like the 13th guest, isn't it?" Yet, reported sightings of the supernumerary figure now begin to drift in. He is seen often in the company of an animal that most describe as a dog, though a few are not so sure, for its eyes glow as if all the creature's interior be a miniature of hell. The best time for a sighting seems to be at around sunset. Just as the axemen are leaving off work and heading for the mess tent, the wind changing here in Pennsylvania as between this world and the next, when one may catch him flitting across the visto behind the party, back at the edge of visibility. Black cloak, white wig, black hat, white stock, black breeches, and so forth, on foot, carrying a three-legged staff with an instrument of some kind affixed. A rumor goes round that he is a surveyor of surveyors, independently hired by the line commissioners to keep an eye upon the first two. But where are the rest of his party? Other interpretations are less earthly. A figure that might arouse no comment in Philadelphia, in these parts 'tis esteemed a wonder, particularly as it shows no sign of having made the passage from there to here. Not, anyway, upon the ground, nor through the forest. Presently in camp, the phrase, "resembles the old gentleman," spoken low, is being heard, in reference to the third surveyor. It having been long understood out here, as Captain Shelby explains, that if one wishes to convey a certain item of spiritual property in consideration of a sum to be paid in advance, why, such a contract may be arranged. The old gentleman is always interested, always buying. Even this long at the trade, as Shelby relates it, still resentful about his exile from the infinite, descended here among the harsh gradients of space, subject to the cruel flow of time, denied the future and the past, and thus his omniscience, whilst, as to drafting contracts, left slightly worse at it than the average Philadelphia lawyer. So when Brother Pritchard, lives just over the ridge there, without the gentleman's noticing, decides to sneak in a force majeure clause that turns out to contain the phrase "acts of God," why, there's a legal crisis, the gentleman wishing to nullify the contract and get his money back, Pritchard seeking to keep the money and his soul as well. Very, very expensive lawyers, all from Philadelphia, are engaged by both parties. The journals and broadsiders get hold of the story, and quite excessive indeed grows the commentary that follows, in prose, verse, and caricature. The gentleman, having virtually invented public sensationalism, which is reckoned, indeed, upon his own torrid shores as entertainment, has no illusions about anyone's motives or the chances for great harm to his case. Yet naively, as others would say disingenuously, he clings to a belief in justice. "Well, I don't know what you may have heard about what we call justice up here," his solicitor advises him, "but don't set your hopes too high. Just enjoy your time in town, visit the shops, take in a show." Hell, of late, has been growing so congested that the gentleman is happy enough to come up to Pennsylvania. Even Philadelphia in the morning rush seems to him a prairie desolate, and who even knows how many years this lawsuit may take. To him, as to the deity, 'tis the blink of an eye. "Damned souls? You think I even like damned souls? I go down to that route called processing, see them crowding in, more and more every day. I grasp the situation, but don't enjoy it. Who could enjoy it?" "Upon consideration, I think you're better advised not to sue in any of our courts. You could get fried like a fritter, and counsel along with you. Don't you have any, machinery for resolving this out there in the cosmos, wherever you come from?" "A legal system? Us? Ha, ha, ha! What for? We're a rubbish tip, sir, for all your worst cases. Not that we get to pick or choose, though we do have to deal with the consequences for eternity, of course. Yet there I go complaining again. Oh, and by the way, I'm anything but out in the cosmos. No, no, being but Earth Devil, local lad, working in fact for his omnipotence these days. Ha, yes, once an equal and respected adversary, now but another contract employee. Ah, woe, and forget about luncheon. Does he even write? Once a century, maybe. If any of these damned souls could see the misery I get, maybe they wouldn't groan so much. Albeit, my lord, my best advice is drop the case. Suppose we just go for the money. He can keep his soul, but posting this kind of debit isn't going to amuse my commissioners. Style it an investment. Say the huge sum was to ensure his corruption. You were developing a damned soul. Already used that one too much. They shut me down a few sessions back, alas. But you seem like a mortal of some ingenuity. Perhaps from time to time we could chat. Those would, of course, be billable hours. Chapter 62. In the Canalaways, on the 22nd of April, the first point of Aries, it snows all night, 4 inches of it upon the ground when the axemen awake and merrily begin to form it into missiles or stuff it down the backs of one another's breeches. Springtide. Mason puts his head out the tent flap and is caught in an intimate avalanche down the side of the tent. Dixon has his hat knocked off by a snowball and goes chasing Tom Hines round the cook wagon. I dreamt of a city to the west of here, Dixon tries to recall, scrying in his coffee mug, the wind blowing wood smoke in his eyes, at some great confluence of rivers, or upon a harbor in some inland sea. A large city, busy, prospering, sacred. A sylvan Philadelphia? Well, yes, now that I put it that way. I hope you are prepared for the possibility that waking Philadelphia is as sacred as anything over here will ever get, Dixon. Observe you not, as we move west, more and more of those forces which cities upon coasts have learned to push away and leave to back inhabitants? The lightning, the winter, an indifference to pain, not to mention fire, blood, and so forth, all measured upon a scale far from Philadelphian, whereunto we and our royal commission and our battery of costly instruments are but fleas in the flea circus. We trespass each day ever more deeply into a world of less restraint in everything. No law, no convergence upon any idea of how life is to be. An interior that grows meanwhile ever more forested, more savage and perilous, until, perhaps at the very longitude of your city, we must reach at last an anti-city, some concentration of fate, some final condition of abandonment, wherein all are unredeemably alone and at hazard as deep as their souls may bear. Lost creatures that make the very Seneca seem Christian and merciful. Hey, chirpy today. Yet do I wish thee joy of thy dreams, Mason. I know the ones just before thy wake are most pleasant to thee. Having myself by then been long awake from reluctance to revisit the horrors of my own and so able to observe thee. How then? Do I talk in my sleep? Is that what you're saying? Oh, aye, but thou needn't worry. No one would ever make it out. 'Tis all another language. I'm talking another language in my sleep, Dixon. Don't see what the whim-wham's about. Possession, that is somebody else's soul possessing my body whilst I sleep. That's what it's about. Why, aye, whilst thou art away dreaming, that's what some would say, and others would add, what of it? Don't squint, ask the reverend. Thou've a dream body, what use to thee's the solid one for the time thou sleep? Here's some wandering soul who may have been centuries without sleep, who may have indeed forgotten what sleep feels like, who, had winding sheets, pockets to carry it, might have offered pounds of gold for even a quarter hour's rest. And here thy body is, as an inn in the wilderness, heated, drained, provisioned, and, but for a beating heart and a dormant brain, vacant. Surely 'tis only the mildest of inconveniences. Then tell me, Mirth, where might this alien ghost be whilst I'm not dreaming? In what sort of humor? Busy looking for another habitation, I'd imagine. Apprehensive? Well, this won't do, will it? Not if thou feel this way. Here, why not have Captain Zhang round some day to stand just outside, listen closely, and see what he can make of it? Too intimate. Half the camp hears it. Some take it for Indians. Axemen say, if so, 'tis a nation they have not yet encountered. Later in the day, as they emerge from a woodline, Mason gesturing eastward to where the encampment has swung into view, a flight of sail. Something waits directly in the path of our parallel. Too sure of itself to feel obliged to come forward and meet us, and lo, what is to become of this rolling gypsy village we've brought with us? Late sun, early shadow in the tent riggings. Pots a-clattering, kitchen smoke sucked out of vents by the wind passing over. None of this may be about either you or me. Our story may lie rather behind and ahead, and only with the transits of Venus, never here in the present, up on the line, whose true drama belongs to others. Darby, Cope, Tom Hines, Mr. Barnes, some new hire we don't even see. And when 'tis all done, I shall only return to Sapperton, no wiser, and someday wake up and not know if any of this happened or if I merely dreamed it, even this very moment, Dixon, which I know is real. Oh, dear. For a while, at any rate, it appears to be the drama of Stig, the Merry Axeman, with everyone else scurrying round out of sight, switching wigs and coats, appearing in the proscenium only when needed. And whom has Stig ever needed, as Mrs. Eggslap is apt to sigh, even in his hearing? But Stig, working diligently upon his axe bit, requires as near to perfect clarity of mind as he may achieve. It is this apparently single-minded concentration that at length draws the attention of Light Fingers McPhee, in the midst of whose rummaging through Stig's sea chest, Stig makes his entrance, axe in hand. "What is this?" he inquires. "Ah, what is this?" brandishing an unrolled sheet of parchment covered with elaborate seals and antiquated writing in some other language, possibly Swedish. Stig holds out his hand. "Give it." McPhee gazes at the axe bit's shining edge, considering. "Indians," he yells. "What does it mean, Indians?" Stig asks of an empty tent, for McPhee has zipped away. Stig roars and chases after him as they go kicking over laundry kettles, tripping over tent guys and causing tents to collapse, stopping at the commissary to throw potatoes and onions at each other furiously for a full minute, till in rides Captain Shelby's co-officer out here, Mr. Joseph Continuation Joe Warford, who detains them both and, after all have proceeded to the cook tent, has a look at the mysterious parchment. Swedish, is it, Stig? Latin, Stig replies. Now then, Stig, out with it, demands Captain Shelby, or them yingle-yanglin' days is past and gone. Very well, I am here on behalf of certain principals in Sweden who believe that the Penns, being secretly creatures of Rome, took illegally the original Svanson land upon which Philadelphia would later come to sit, and thus that the whole metropolis has never ceased to belong rightfully to Sweden. What, Swedish Jacobites? Exclaims Dixon, sort of thing. Why, Stig? Amid the glitter of your great world, the flame of our cause may be easily overlooked. Yet it burns hotly enough that certain hands long accustomed to thievery durst not venture too close. Swedes have been here from the beginning, living among the Indians in peace, with no need to obtain their land falsely. Indeed, for Penn, Swedes were but another tribe of Indian, residing within his American grant, whose priority there he found no less irksome. Which is why, at bottom, there ever was a boundary dispute, and these astronomers are come here at all. Stig, cries Mrs. Eggslap, I had no idea. Why, you can talk. I'll go bail for him gladly, Your Grace. Surely, protests the camp lawyer, Mr. Barnes, if this be a Swedish claim, 'tis advanced in a less than timely way, sir. 80 years and more, kings have come and gone. How do you expect to fare in this? I am but an agent, sir. For a greater view of motive and interest, beyond our own simple desire for justice, you might ask among your Jesuitic acquaintance. If that's a remark about me, Dixon in full truculency. Gentlemen, ladies, cries the justice of the peace, must I read the Riot Act? I do so, I am told, most affectingly, having been compared indeed with Mr. Whitefield, though I take in far less in donations, of course. This seems to many a blatant request for a bribe, though others maintain 'tis but innocent joking. Now then, Stig, give us your account, man. Do any of you know, Stig inquires, what I have come down to you out of? the frost eternal, the whiteness abounding, beneath that all-night sun. In the Royal Library in Copenhagen lies an ancient vellum manuscript, a gift from Bishop Brynjolf to Frederick III, containing tales of the first Northmen in America, of those long winters and the dread miracles that must come to pass before spring, the blood, the ghosts and fetches, the prophecies and second sight, and the melancholy suggestion that the new continent Europeans found had been long attended from its own ancient days by murder, slavery, and the poor fragments of a magic irreparably broken. To enter the Capes of Delaware was thus, for me, to pass the Pillars of Hercules, not outward into the simple mysteries of an open sea, but inward, branching, narrowing, compressing toward an enigma as opaque and perilous as any in my travels. All day we ascended, and at dusk finally approached Philadelphia Irredempta, ceaselessly a clamor in the torchlight, headlong, as if in continuous arrival from the future, the Mesopotamian idol of the Svanssons, as vanished as Eden. As I stood among the hectic mobility at dockside, uncertain as to my next step, a foreign hand tapped at my mantle. A voice bade me good day, using my Christian name. I shivered, though I seldom do, ordinarily. 'Twas not a voice I knew, yet terribly I knew it well. Unprepared for any reception here, nonetheless I went with him through the necessary exchanges of counterseals and words that may never be written down and the like. I stammered some kind of thanks for having been met. I can remember no longer what he looked like. A closed carriage approached. 'Old,' cries Captain Shelby. 'What is this? Elect Cohens? Bavarian Rosicrucians? Come, Stig, admit it. You're not Swedish at all, are you?' 'Sir, 'tis for you to work out. Let us say that my people are of the north, northern and very white. So white, in fact, that you British to us appear as do Africans to you.